It's New Letters on the Air. Today I talk with novelist, poet, and short story writer Anthony Grooms. A two-time winner of the Lillian Smith Award, Grooms' writing frequently features the South and what he calls the mythology of the Civil Rights Movement. He talks about his fiction and the inspiration behind it.
I started to hear gossip and jokes and stories coming in all directions with all different textures of emotion that you can't get from history. And that is what really hooked me into telling stories about the Civil Rights Movement.
Stay with us for a conversation with Anthony Grooms on this edition of New Letters on the Air, produced at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elung. Born in Charlottesville, Virginia in 1955, Anthony Grooms was a bit too young to fully participate in the Civil Rights Movement, but its influence and the experience of others permeate his work. His 1995 collection of short stories called Trouble No More was his first book to win the Lillian Smith Award, which honors writing that centers around social inequities. In 2002, he won the award again, joining Alice Walker as the only writer to win it twice. I talked with Anthony Grooms about what's behind this powerful novel, starting with why it's called Bombingham.
Bombingham is a nickname for Birmingham, given to it by its black citizens. Starting after World War II, and really up into the 70s, well, let me put it this way. By the time of the famous church bombing in September of 1963, the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing that killed four girls and injured a couple of dozen other people, some of them still permanently injured from that, up to that time, there had been 60 bombings, and then there were bombings after that time, too, but we focus on that bombing because it was dramatic and people died in it, and it happened at a church, so it has become, in a way, symbolic of the struggle and the oppression that people were struggling against. There were so many bombings and house burnings in that area that were unsolved, and there's good evidence that they were unsolved because the police were involved in them, or at least ignored the people who were doing it, allowed the bombings and burnings to occur. Incidentally, Angela Davis grew up in one of the Birmingham neighborhoods, one that is called Pleasant Hill, but also called Dynamite Hill because of all the bombings there. And you wonder what might radicalize a person. Then if you see your neighbors get bombed every other week, yeah, that might radicalize you.
Oh, heck yeah. It's interesting to me because you don't just deal with the people who are gung-ho about the Civil Rights Movement. A lot of your characters are ambivalent about it. You know, they don't want to rock the boat. They have gotten to some degree of comfort, even though they are living these very segregated lives and still being very oppressed in the everyday world. But the way that you capture that ambivalence in various scenes is powerful.
Thank you. When I start to write a book, it's really a wide open exploration. I have characters in mind and situations in mind. But as I draft along, two, three drafts down, I begin to discover problems that I want to work with. And one of the problems was this idea of what I call the mythology of the Civil Rights Movement. And that mythology is that all black people were gung-ho when King came to town in Birmingham and wanted social change. And that's one of the mythologies. But in fact, I know from my own experience growing up, not in Birmingham, but in Virginia, that black people were ambivalent about the Civil Rights Movement. And there were black people who said what many white people were saying, and that is that, you know, slow down, things are going too fast. And it's not that those folks didn't want social change. It was that they were afraid of exactly what they said, of moving too fast. And they were afraid of the change itself. You know, they had gotten to a place where they were comfortable and they knew what to expect. And, you know, change always brings some degree of things unexpected. So that's one of the things that I do talk about in my story. I have a mother who, among other things, is not gung-ho about the Civil Rights Movement. And she doesn't want her children involved in the Civil Rights Movement. The father, though he has been involved in social demonstrations before.
Though we don't find that out until deep into the novel.
He's very quiet about it.
Yes.
And in some ways, he's totally disillusioned about it. And so he isn't much interested in the movement either.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how the mother, you know, she works for a black man who has become very powerful within their community. And she keeps herself and her children's lives isolated from having to deal with the issues of segregation in some ways.
Yeah, she is, in fact, a segregationist. But she has some privilege because she works for A.G. Gaston, who has a very interesting story that begins in great poverty, and he ends up being one of the richest people in Alabama, and a black man. And he's rich in part because of the segregation laws, and he controls a lot of the resources in the black community. But because she works for him, then she can isolate herself from the daily dealings in Jim Crow society. She can be a secretary and come home to a nice middle-class black neighborhood. And unlike Mrs. Burrell, the other mother in the story, who has to daily cross the racial divide to work in white women's homes, Mrs. Burrell has to create strategies for dealing with Jim Crow, whereas Mother doesn't.
We should talk some about the main character of the book, Walter, and he's the son of these two. And what's really wonderful about the structure of this book, we start off with a scene where Walter is a young man fighting in Vietnam, and then there's a beautiful segue back into his childhood, the transition where you go from the opening scene in Vietnam, which I thought about having you read, but I would have to beep it so much that... I decided not to, but it's a very powerful opening to it. But what Walter is dealing with so much in his life, and actually what a lot of your characters out of Trouble No More deal with too, is not only that ambivalence, but with loss. This is a theme of yours, isn't it?
I think so. And it's interesting that I think as we go through life as writers and artists, we discover themes. They often aren't what we think we're setting out to do. It's an exploration, and then something snags you and won't let go, and you find that I keep coming back to this idea. And loss certainly is one of them. Of course, Walter loses his mother, but it hardens him in a way that he has to learn to deal with loss and still remain moral and human. And I think that that is a challenge for us all. I mean, we also have to learn how to deal with disappointments and losses and shortcomings, and not to become petty and or even evil, and think about the choices we make, whether or not they're the right ones, at least not to go into them blindly.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I really like about this book is that you make Walter so human. In essence, we see a lot of horrible things happen, demeaning things that happen to Walter. But then we also see the other side of Walter when he himself becomes cruel in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that sense of the dangers of being human, basically.
Well, it is human. We as human beings have great capacities for good and unfortunately great capacities for evil. Many times the evil comes about because we aren't paying attention to what we're doing. We aren't thinking about what we're doing. Walter says he's loose. He's lost his direction. And part of that is because he's allowing himself to float through and to not think about painful things. And thinking about those painful things might, in fact, help him decide what not to do in his case.
Well, I did mark a place towards the end of the book where you describe a scene. And I might, just to kind of give a sense of how you are able to really show a scene of action in the book. Tony, you're such a wonderful writer. I mean, I have to confess, when I finished this book this morning and I bawled my eyes out. I mean, I really did. Just because...
Oh, that makes me so happy.
But just because of the humanness of the story, you know, and how tough it is, I don't know. And especially with everything going on in the world right now, it just really hit me in my heart. But this particular scene kind of gives a sense of the violence that's going on at the time, and you might want to set it up.
Okay. This is a scene towards the end of the book, and what has happened is that the civil rights demonstrators, King and Shuttlesworth, have met with the downtown merchants, and they've come to some conclusion about the demonstrations, and from the perspective of this narrator, an unsatisfactory conclusion. But nonetheless, that's supposedly been put aside, and there's peace to reign in Birmingham. But in fact, there were many people unhappy, including Governor George Wallace, who sent in the state police against the wishes, actually, of the city government. These policemen pretty much began a riot so that they could have way. I should also say that that evening began with two bombings, one at the house of A.D. King, the brother of Martin Luther King, who was a minister in Birmingham, and one at the Gadsden Motel, where King was staying up until that time. He'd only recently left to come back to Atlanta. So young Walter Burke is seeking out his father, who is staying at the hotel. He finds him, and they try to get out of the area of danger. We found shelter with a group in the alcove under the marquee of the Carver Theater as a phalanx of state troopers, not city policemen, shoved past us. This was how our governor answered the end of the demonstrations. The state troopers were dressed like combat soldiers, helmets, boots, and flak jackets. They had dogs and billy clubs, and something I'd never seen before then, carbines. When a dog attacked, the troopers let the leashes go slack and let the dogs maul the victims. When someone did not move fast enough, they thunked his head with the clubs. The whacking and thumping and cracking sounded like a parade of out-of-tune drums. "Ain't this some sh-?" the man in the Motown suit said as he joined us under the marquee. "I ain't fixing to take this." Suddenly, there was a whoosh. A building about a block and a half away went up in a blaze. "The food store," the Motown man exclaimed. "The damn food store, what the hell?" The firelight trimmed the streetscape in flickering orange. It reflected from the faces of the people, eyes wide with fear or narrow with rage. It reflected from the golden eagle insignia on the helmets of the troopers. The helmets shaded the troopers' eyes. All that could be seen of their faces were their tight lips and teeth. The fire spread quickly to other buildings, or perhaps other buildings were set afire. At any rate, panic was on two fronts as the troopers pushed the crowd toward the burning buildings. A woman in night clothes, having been chased from bed by the flames, joined us under the marquee. "What's going on?" she asked my father. When he didn't answer, she turned to the Motown man. "They're trying to kill us all," he said. Now the center of the melee was right in front of us, people running first one way and then the other as the troopers trapped and beat us. Then, as if they were on the end of a flicking whip, the troopers turned on us. "Get indoors," they ordered. "Get your black ass off the street." They kicked and swung the clubs and let the dogs bite arms and legs. The Motown man sprung like a cat into the back of a trooper. He raked the trooper with a glinting switchblade, slicing into the trooper's shoulder. As if with one mind, five troopers turned on the Motown man, hammering and hammering him with their clubs. "You'll kill him," my father screamed and started toward them. I grabbed at my father, caught his belt, but he had already drawn the attention of the troopers. The fury turned on my father and me. Father spun around, pushed me into the corner of the alcove, and lay on top of me. I could feel the clubbing reverberate through his body, a torrent coming down on him. He tensed, groaned. I heard him lose his breath as the air was knocked from him. The attack was brief and furious, a dozen strong blows. My father lay still, and the fury moved on.
That's a scene from the novel Bombingham by Anthony Grooms, and it was the winner of the Lillian Smith Award for Fiction, 2001. That's a powerful scene. Actually, there's that scene where they first start blasting the people who are marching with the water which you have a water scene in your short stories, too,
yeah,
in Trouble No More.
It's really kind of the genesis of Birmingham.
I wondered if that's where it started. Mm-hmm. It's not written in the same way, mm-hmm. but you could tell that there were some similarities there. You didn't ever live in Birmingham. I was surprised to find that out after I read mm-hmm. this. But tell me about what drew you to the stories. Obviously, I understand the big picture of what drew you to the story of Birmingham, but how did you as a writer decide that was going to be what you really wanted to explore?
Well, I fell in love. is the truth. I grew up in Virginia, and as a young man beginning my teaching career, I moved to Georgia. And there I met a woman who had grown up in Birmingham.
Ah.
And so I started to date her and to meet her family and to get involved in her very interesting and, to put quotes around, lively family. They are very engaging people. Being with them, I started to hear stories of the civil rights movement. And of course, I'd been interested in the subject for a while, but in an intellectual and distant way, and most of the knowledge I had about it had come through books and television. So now I was getting stories from the people, some of them who had actually been involved in demonstrations. My father-in-law had been in a demonstration. My mother-in-law really kind of took the opposite side of it. And again, to say that she was very much interested in civil rights, or in those days, as they say, our freedom. But she didn't want to be in the streets in order to achieve it. But I started to hear gossip and jokes and stories coming in all directions with all different textures of emotion that you can't get from history. And that is what really hooked me into telling stories about the civil rights movement.
Mm. They're so real. It was hard for me to not believe that you didn't have some personal presence during that. I mean, you did such a great job of researching and then using your imagination to set up the scenes. I mean, I really was drawn in and really felt like I was there. And it's interesting because you have some very vivid scenes of action in Vietnam, but you didn't serve in Vietnam, did you?
I did not serve in Vietnam. I am happy to say I didn't have that experience firsthand. I knew people who did. And I was in one of the lotteries for Vietnam, and the lottery I actually won by losing. This was a very scary time for me because as I looked at my life then through middle school and high school, all I could see was that I would finish school and go off to Vietnam. That was the track I thought I was on. And being not just being a black child, but being a rural child, that is the future I saw. In the county I grew up in, outside of Charlottesville, Virginia, where there's the wonderful University of Virginia, but we weren't part of that crowd. The track I saw led into the military, and then, you know, if you were lucky enough to get through that someplace else, I didn't see myself going to college in those days.
So, in a way, the character of Walter takes the track of that life that you did not take. It was the road not taken, basically.
That is true. By and large, I enjoy going where no man has gone before, at least in my head.
Inhabiting those different lives.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's the fun for me. And you know, people talk about sweating blood and all of that. I guess I get frustrated at times, but it's not the writing process that frustrates me. It's generally not having time to do it and then dealing with other business associated with it. But writing is a great deal of fun. I mean, it's a guilty pleasure in some aspects when you think there are people digging ditches. And when I'm writing in my house, I kind of hate it when a workman comes to the house and is working and doing a physical job, and I'm sitting there at the computer and I'm thinking, gosh, that guy's thinking I'm doing nothing.
You know, I wonder if part of the reason why your writing is so visual for me and I can see it, I noticed when I was reading some background on you that you've written a couple of plays.
A long time ago, well, my first creative writing training was as a playwright, and I liked writing plays. I wasn't a good person for the theater, though. I wasn't as collaborative as I think it requires a playwright to be. And, you know, I didn't like actors changing my lines or whatever. So I am far more comfortable with fiction. Fiction has its collaborative aspects as well, but it is largely a solo act.
You like having that control of what your characters
maybe
say.
Maybe I'm a control freak. I don't know. Yes, I like having that control and having the responsibility that it all comes down to me. I don't have to get mad at an actor for blowing it. You know, that's not what I meant, because ultimately, whether it's successful or not, it's what I wrote.
Yeah. And you have a love for dialogue, I think, which may have attracted you to theater in the first place.
Well, actually, the theater writing, to take it as a course in college, was because at that time, my undergraduate college, William & Mary, only offered creative writing in the theater. And I just kind of stumbled into it, and I got praise. and I was kind of hooked into doing that, and I ended up with a lot of theater credits and not very many in anthropology, which was my presumed major. So then I had to kind of shuffle majors in order to get out of school and into another school. But I think I learned a lot from that experience about dialogue and what dialogue has to do. And I do like dialogue. I like to listen to people and all the funny things they say and the funny ways in which they say them.
Did you happen to bring any of your poetry with you?
I have a couple of poems here.
Okay, before we go to that, I wanted this other short passage, the scene at the funeral of the mother. In some ways, it pulls together a lot of the themes that are going on in the book.
We had been crying all morning. Neither Josie nor I wanted to go to Mother's funeral. It was hot that afternoon, and my Easter suit was scratchy. The hearse met us in front of Grandma Pick's house. I remember walking by the hearse and seeing the coffin through the rear window. It's a space capsule, I told myself. Inside there were oxygen and lights and radar screens and radios, compasses, and the excitement of taking an exotic journey. On the way to the church, we rode behind the hearse in the undertaker's limousine. I remember my father's face looked bruised, and he moved his neck stiffly from the billy club beating. I remember how the white policeman stopped traffic at the one intersection in Coushatta to let the procession pass. The policeman took off his hat as the hearse passed, and some of the white men on the sidewalk, turning, looking with curious faces, did likewise. The countryside had been baked by drought. The crops were stunted, and the brown and plowed areas had a dead color as if the red soil had been dusted with talc. I had the sensation, sitting in quiet numbness with my family, that we were moving through a dreamscape, not nightmarish, but visionary. Something about the place was also like something about every place I had ever been or would ever go. The scientists tell us that the entire universe was in one place at the beginning, and so all of it was right here on the roadside on the way to my mother's funeral. What was the difference, after all, between a crossroads like Coushatta and a hamlet like Toibo, between Birmingham and Da Nang? Are they not just places full of people, and the people full of hopes and struggles? Here a field, there a paddy, here peanuts, there rice, here a church, there a temple. We are always ready, are we not, to point out the obvious differences, but just below the surface, or maybe just on top of it, visible to those who would see it, invisible to those who would not, is the incontrovertible proof that the world is a tumultuous place, and every soul in it suffers.
I thought that was so beautifully written and so fitting for the time that we're in now. I mean, with all that's going on around the world. And the
bombing of the cradle of civilization.
Exactly. That was a segment from towards the end of the novel Bombingham, winner of the Lillian Smith Award for Fiction. And you've been listening to Anthony Grooms. And before we close, I wanted to see if I could get you to read a couple of poems, because we haven't even talked about that. Your very first book was a chapbook of poems, which now, sadly, is out of print. I know that you got into writing through your playwriting, but mm-hmm. before that, when did you first start writing, and was it poetry?
Actually, the first writing was poetry.
Somehow that doesn't surprise me because of your attention to detail.
Thank you. But the first training was in playwriting, but the first writing was poetry and then short stories and then plays and then training, and that kind of went along the same line. I trained as a playwright, then as a poet, and then as a fiction writer. And I've always continued to write poems, even though I consider myself primarily a writer of fiction. And since so much of my fiction and poems deal with things that are generally unhappy, I want to read a poem that deals with something a little more hopeful. And to set it up, this poem grows out of an experience I had in Ghana, West Africa. I'd gone there to a small town called Cape Coast where there's a university to teach. And one of the teachers I've met, also a visiting teacher, is named Wolf. He's in the poem, and he's from Germany. And there's a little boy in the poem called Joe. Joe was recently adopted by one of the professors at the university, and he's about six. And in the month or so that he'd been with the professor, he hadn't smiled in spite of our trying to get him to smile, tickling and teasing him and so forth. But we go to the beach one day, and he starts to play in the surf, and he starts to laugh, and we're having a great time, and we're drinking what the Ghanaians sometimes call minerals, a flavor called bitter lemon. I'm reading a book called The Beautiful Ones Are Not Yet Born, which is an awfully sad existential exploration of Ghanaian life. So this is a poem called Minerals from the Sea. I'm drinking minerals made of the sea, bitter lemon and salt that's crusted my lips. Joe is smiling for the first time in life. The sea is dancing on the sand, hula-hooping. Wolf is reading Annie Proulx and enjoying it. I'm reading The Beautiful Ones Are Not Yet Born. But they have been born. Joe has been born. He lies down in the surf. His baby black body mixes with the white tongues of the foam. He's a picture that I take in like a breath of salt air. Why is this happiness possible? At any moment, the world might crack like an egg, but I will still be happy. I will dance upon its yolk. I will sing Gershwin tunes and dream of PJ. I'm about the luckiest man in the world to have a little girl like you. I have discovered what has already been known. The sea is rough, but it dances. It is hoarse, but it sings. You can look upon the end of the world as an end, or as a means to an end. The end is beyond the world it lives in.
Anthony Grooms. His novel Bombingham is available in paperback, published in 2002 by One World Ballantine. If you'd like to purchase a cassette of today's show or receive our free catalog, call 888-548-2477. Our email address is newletters@art.net. And that toll-free number again is 888-LIT-AIRS. Your station also has this information. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters, the quarterly magazine of fine literature and art published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial funding from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Leslie Koffler is our assistant producer. Our interns are Jeannie Irons and Tina Meggs, and I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.